You're listening to Around Comics, episode 94. Chicago, this is Around Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Brian Salazar. Our regular host, Chris Niesman, is off on his honeymoon, so I'll be filling in this week. With me, as always, is the man behind the magic, the funniest man in podcasting, Tom Caters.
It's going to be awkward this week, I can already tell, because I'm going to have to read more. That's not good for this. That's not good for anyone.
And joining us, as always, is the man of a dozen voices, and especially the voice of Word Balloon, John Suntress.
Heidi ho. I hope Chris is having a fine honeymoon.
I'm sure he'll post about it. It was a coin toss.
It was, honey, if we could just one more day. I'm just saying. I'm just asking.
This humidity is killing my Absolute editions that I brought with me.
Remember when he was telling us how he couldn't bring his laptop? And his
He brought his laptop on his honeymoon.
Because he's been posting to the forum during his honeymoon.
Just consummated marriage, .. Am looking forward to breakfast in the morning, ..
No, it's all like, Captain America's awesome. Like, that's what he's thinking about his honeymoon.
Honey, I'm really sorry. I have to get off this thought about the JLA-JSA crossover with the Legion before we continue. Let's see what our guest is.
I was wondering why he was Googling, comic conventions in Tahiti the last time.
Yeah. Ooh, look. Chi is appearing.
And also joining us this week is comics veteran and our pal, Hilary Barda.
Hi.
How you doing,
Hill? That's his Lank Thompson voice. You're a handsome man, Hilary Barda.
Well, you only did one of your thousand voices, so I thought I'd do one of the others.
Yeah. Very cool.
I'm fine. Thank you for asking.
It's actually 500, but he's got a male and female for each one.
Sal, I was on the ESPN Chicago affiliate tonight doing Jerry Reinsdorf talking about the Sox and the Bulls.
You're kidding me.
We got a good team.
Oh, great. You were interviewing Jerry?
McNeil called me up. Because apparently Reinsdorf would not come on. He would only come on to talk about the Jackie Robinson weekend last weekend and not talk about the Bulls and the Sox last week. And it's what are you, nuts? It's like, dude, you own these two teams. They're in action. End of the season for the Bulls. Sox kind of struggling at the beginning of the baseball season. Well, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about Jackie Robinson and the importance of him in the game.
So you came on doing...
And I did Jerry Reinsdorf.
Very nice. And it was on ESPN 1000?
Yes. And basically it's like Dick Tracy's villain mumbles. It's like Jerry Reinsdorf.
Tune in right now.
It's on now.
If you could have posed a question to Jerry Reinsdorf, it would have been, dude, are you nuts? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of. He's been very cool. He knows that I do.
Not as nuts as Jackie Robinson.
He goes, is that really? You really think that's how I talk? And I'm like, yeah.
He does.
And he goes, I hate the way I sound. I'm like, sorry, man. I'm like, yeah, but you got money. You'll get over it.
Yeah. Well,
he's
no
a
kidding.
Good guy. Actually, honestly,
how about
I like
that no-hitter? Huh?
Very cool. Mark Burley.
Welcome to Baseball Cast.
B. Clay Moore, I'll bring it back to comics. Huge Sox fan.
Yes, he is.
Walking Sammy made up for it by picking him off.
Yes.
That was nice.
That's brilliant.
That was sweet.
Nice. See, we're Chicago fans.
Hey, and a little trivia someone brought to my attention. In the box score, Burley faced less than the minimum because Sammy's walk is not an official at-bat. So he only faced 26.
Wow.
Interesting cool. little tidbit for you baseball fans out there.
Said it's one of the few games where a guy hit for the cycle, grand slam, and
no. It was two home runs by the same guy, Jim Thome, a grand slam by Jermaine Dye, and a no-no. Never had happened before.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool.
Pretty cool. All right, anyway, before we go too further into baseball talk, I want to remind everyone that this episode is presented by InStockTrades.com.
Waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 ship free. Whether you're buying an Absolute Edition or catching up with showcases and essentials, InStockTrades.com is your new best friend. So say goodbye to your old one. It's an online store has replaced them.
Later, Gary Price. Yeah. InStockTrades has got my BFF ring now.
And as always, Around Comics is recorded every Friday night at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please stop by. We would love to meet you. When you're here, remember to ask about Dark Tower's pull list membership. It's one of the best you'll find anywhere. Dark Tower has a great selection of mainstream comics, indie comics, trades, as well as statues, action figures, and quarter books.
I cover statues.
As Tom found out today, a great selection of quarter books. Come to Dark Tower for all your comics and collectible needs.
Yeah, you know,
thank
really.
God for you. I'm glad you explained the pull list, because that meant something else when I was a kid.
I get your pull list.
He's on the pull list.
You found an assload of amazing
quarter
Silver
books.
Age and Bronze Age comics. And I'm so jealous.
It's going to inspire a new segment later in the episode.
I mean, it smells like the crawl space when the comics have been riding there for like 10 years.
It smells like fun died.
Exactly.
And it smells even better than it did.
You're saying his ass load smells like a fun died?
Fun died.
Sure. I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
And speaking of fun dying, your Around Comics experience nice. Isn't complete until you've read this week's Long Box of Love. Each Thursday episode of Around Comics is a wonderfully handcrafted wooden webcomic from Brian Bull.
Wooden.
Check it out every Thursday at www.aroundcomics.com.
All right. Well, this week, normally we do an interview or a topic discussion, and this week we're kind of doing a little bit of both. We invited Hillary back just because we love talking with Hillary and his vast knowledge of the history of comics.
My geezer lore.
You're old, man.
That's what they want. My geezer lore.
Hillary, what was it like when Stan Lee was a kid, Hillary?
No, but it's cool, man, because, yeah, you grew up reading them and have been...
You grew
Hillary
up reading
them
for how long? How long have you been in comic
I can't
industry?
Even remember.
Come on.
When no, things get blurry back when I was doing drugs, but... it's been 20 years, maybe.
Cool, man. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you remember what your first published work was?
Yeah, I'm not telling you.
Come on.
Was it a letter to Challengers of the Unknown?
Oh, we're not counting
on,
letters,
man.
Are we?
You got, you know.
I already told you, I had a letter printed in Charlton at one point.
Which book? Son of Vulcan?
No.
Son of Vulcan 8, look for the Hillary Barta letter.
I think it was in...
In the collected edition.
It was in... Phantom.
Okay, cool.
Very nice.
Phantom. Strong the Phantom.
That was
beautiful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
Was it a negative letter?
No, not at all. It was a real, you know, brown-nosing fanboy letter. Yeah.
Nice.
I wish I lived in the Skull Cave with my own dog and knife and gun that I never use. And had ancestors Rochelle. That also wore the same clothes as me. Do they stink? Does his leotard stink? Signed, Hillary Barta.
Dear Hillary, thank you for your inquiry.
All right.
I am fine. John Newton.
All right, Hillary, you've been in comics for over 20 years now. What was it like breaking in for you, and what was the industry like then?
Well, I remember being told that I got in at a good time. I think they might have meant that if I had tried 5 years later, they never would have hired me because I sucked.
Did they say that in wink?
Like, yeah.
You got in at a good
exactly.
time.
Hillary, you're lucky you got in when you did, because we never would have hired you now.
Yeah, much better guys now.
But there were a number of artists, you know, close to my age, and we were all trying to break in. And we would go to the Chicago Comic Book Convention.
Around what year was this?
Well, we were hanging around at the conventions from the 70s. I mean, I even went to one when it was downtown at the YMCA. And
in the showers.
But
the books are all soapy. Yeah.
Hello, boys. Soapy up, and I'll tell you all about Flint Speed.
That wasn't a convention, Hill. at least not a comic book convention.
But the first time I showed my portfolio to anybody, it was... At probably the Pick Congress downtown.
Cool.
That's where they held the convention before they moved it out to Rosemont. And, you know, I was really lucky. The first time I showed my portfolio, it was to Al Milgram, who was then an editor at Marvel. And Al said, "This is good. You know, I think I could get you some work." And I hadn't really struggled. I was You know, I was working as a floor sander at the time. That was fun, but you know, I wasn't trying to break in.
Like
I got
a floor sander.
Trying to break into the floor sanding business.
All right. Yeah. Enough floor sanding talk, please.
This is what it's been like.
Yeah. Okay. All right, but before you go into that part, what was it about? Why were you trying to break into comics? What was it about comics? Were you a fan before that, and artistically, what was your background before you got into comics?
I've been doing artistic stuff since I was a kid, and then I think I read comics when I was young, I didn't really think of comics either as a career or really as an art form that I would be involved in until maybe high school. And in high school, I was in Evanston at the time, and there was this Graphis, a European arts magazine, and they did an issue on comics around the world, and suddenly I'm looking at both classic American comics, things like The Spirit that I hadn't really seen before, European books, Italian, Japanese, and...
The influences then were that it's interesting because weren't a lot of those artists brought in to work in the mainstream because they were cheaper. I mean, wasn't there like that Filipino explosion at DC?
Oh well, all that stuff happened in comics. Yeah, I mean, so when I got exposed to this stuff in high school, and at that time in the 70s, there was a kind of a renaissance going on in comics because a whole new generation of people had come in that were comic fans. I mean, prior to that, artists got into comics. Really, it was sort of like comics was a stepping stone on the way into either illustration or some other field, but comics were considered pretty low class. And there were artists who made it their career and really, you know, did wonderful work, but it wasn't terribly respected as an art form, you know. And that changed in the 70s, I think, because all these guys came in, these young kids who grew up loving these artists. They revered the form and the people, you know, that they were emulating, and things started changing. But anyway, I was exposed to all this stuff outside of American comics, too. And they weren't necessarily working here. But it was just this kind of... I didn't realize comics could be all these different kinds of things. And it was a wonderful time to kind of be alive. And I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. We can cut this part out.
It was a great time.
Yeah. Who were some of those guys?
No, but what I was going to say, actually, what's interesting is back then it was a lot harder to see a lot of this stuff. Nowadays, you can click... You can Google any artist you want,
right?
Whether they're in comics or whether they, you know, draw matchbook covers, you probably can find their work. Back then, you know, discovering their stuff either in a box in the back of an old magazine or comic book store, or finding it in a magazine like this, it was a revelation, you know, because this stuff wasn't easily available.
I was going to ask how did you get exposed to that stuff?
Cite that one magazine because that was a big thing. But once I saw that these people were out there, and Eisner, for instance, was in there because Eisner was somebody I didn't really know much about. I then went into the comic stores and found out that he'd been working in Undergrounds, that he had this whole history, you know, and I started buying Spirits, and eventually Kitchen came out with Spirit reprints, which was great. I bought the early little ones in the black and white even before the magazine came out, you know, and all that stuff.
Books.
So, I don't know.
Once you notice stuff, you start.
Yeah, you just one thing leads you to another, and you know, one artist you find one artist. But I mean, growing up as a kid, I loved old movies. I watched old black. We had a black and white television set. And to me, everything was in black and white. I didn't even know The Wizard of Oz was in color halfway through.
Wow.
You know?
It's blowing your mind when you said that.
We didn't have a color TV the entire time I was growing up. And I would stay up late, and I'd even sneak down after I supposedly was in bed. You know, I'd go down and watch The Late Show, and I'd watch these old movies. And I loved old detective and crime movies and comedies and musicals, The Marx Brothers, all that stuff. And finding out that there was this corresponding history of comics was a wonderful thing. Because I just loved the period of the 40s and 30s, 40s, and 50s. You know.
So after that, I mean, when did you sort of make the decision that it was something you wanted to try and do for a living?
Well, I knew that, I loved film and I loved comics. And for a while I kind of pursued film. But it was just easier to get into comics. And it's easier because you can... go to a comic book convention, and there's a comic book editor right there. And in those days, they would have portfolio review time set aside. The guy would be sitting there, and you'd walk right up and say, "Hi, Mr. Editor, you know, would you please take a look at my portfolio?" And they would critique your work or, you know, not. But it was very organized, very accessible, and, you know, Everybody I knew that wanted to get into comics did it that way.
You mentioned Milgram. Who were some of the other guys?
Well, Al Milgram was the guy who actually... And I showed my work, I think, at the same convention, I might have showed my work to a couple other people. And believe me, I was pretty bad. You know, my samples, you know, my portfolio was terrible. But...
What was in it?
Well, probably there wasn't much comics, because I mostly had illustrations and stuff. So they thought to hire me as an inker, because I wasn't showing them comics, I was showing them pen and ink work.
Right.
So Al said he'd give me work, and it probably took, like, about 2 years... after he gave me like 2 pages of the Defenders to ink over Ron Perlman.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, when I look back at anything I did in the first 5 years or so, it's real bad, but that was particularly bad. And it was you know,
which issue, so people can go like,
you know, up to your conventions and say, please
and laugh at you.
I even got an X-Men thing, which I won't even tell you about because you'll find that, but I'm not, that was pretty bad.
Oh, we'll find it anyway.
I butchered something there.
I was going to say who was
eventually I got an issue that. Of the Defenders, and then they offered me The Thing or something, and I, you know, all that stuff was, I didn't know what I was doing then. I really
didn't
know.
How long did it take for you to, like, is there a point now where you look back at stuff and say that's pretty good? You know, like, at
well,
old
where
stuff
your work started?
That would, it would be foolish for me to do that at any point, probably. But no, I stopped hating what I was doing.
Yeah.
When I realized how bad that stuff, I first had to go through that period of realization, because when you're doing it, you're not doing bad work intentionally. You think you're doing good work. I remember I was working on something in my apartment. I had a party, and I had some art out in my studio, and George Freeman is an artist, a Canadian guy, fantastic artist, done a number of things over the years. At that time, he was drawing Captain Canuck, I think. Was that a strip?
Captain
yeah.
Canuck, absolutely.
But he's done a lot of things. And
according to comicbookdatabase.com, you
yes?
did issue 243 in April of 1989. The Ashes was the title of that book.
What's that?
Uncanny X-Men. But that's probably not what you're talking
no,
about.
No,
that's
no,
probably
no, 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 no. They won't even talk about you. Don't. I'm
you
not,
won't find
I'm
it.
Not
build,
are these they, unbilled assignments?
Yeah, it's no fair. No. It was billed, and I'm not going to give you the information. You're going to look it up on your little computer there.
Sorry.
No, I inked Dave Cockrum on a backup story and stuff, some X book.
Wow.
And it was really, I just like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. It was terrible. I mean, it was painful. And the fact that I got another job after doing any of those jobs, I still
but you
find
went,
it
you went through the process of, you know, you were talking about being at that party with George.
Well, George came in was looking at what I was doing, and he said, Hillary, first of all, I didn't know George was going to be there. It was kind of a fun surprise. And George Freeman is, you know, fantastic artist then. I mean, he really was really, really good. And so I was, you know, anything he said, I would listen to. He said, why are you inking with a pen? He said, you're trying to make a pen look like a brush. I was too timid to fight my way through, because it takes a little while to get a brush to do what you want to do. You kind of got to wrestle it, you know, get the feel for it. A pen, you can pretty much put it right down on the paper and you can get a line.
Yeah.
Brush, you know, it's splashing all over the place. You can't control the line weight as easily because it's all about touch. And he said, Hillary, just get rid of that pen and pick up a brush. And pretty much from that day, I went out and bought a bunch of brushes. I tried using the brushes, and I stuck with it, and that's what I use mostly, you know. And it really changed the way I work. And I started liking my work more at that point.
Did other artists help you along, or were there editors, too, that were helping you in terms of developing better storytelling?
Yeah, there were, you know, I don't know what kind of programs they have now at companies, but they used to have certain editors that they would use to break in new talent. Or maybe that was something they liked to do, but they had, I remember Carl Potts at Marvel was a great guy, because, first of all, Carl was just a really decent, you know, generous guy, and he would give you a lot of time, and he'd want to work with people that were really, you know, talent in the raw, or people that he knew had talent but weren't quite getting there yet, and he'd help you along. And one thing he would send you is a photocopied version of a book called The 5 C's of Cinematography. And it was a book about filmmaking, but it, you know, a lot of the rules of filmmaking can apply to comics in terms of the direction of the camera or in the readers, you know.
Composition of the panel.
Well, keeping continuity from shot to shot or panel to panel in comics, you know, those sort of things can cross over from, you know, there are rules about visual storytelling that were in that book, but also subtle things like heroic camera angles and left to right and just cultural reasons for why this is positive, this is negative. Anyways, a fascinating book, and I know he gave that to every freelancer that ever, you know, started out in comics working for him. And Carl also, he told me a lesson. It was like this Zen thing, which is it was mostly about inking, but I guess it's about drawing in particular. But it's like you need to tighten up and loosen up. And essentially, you need to get the skills. You need to be on, you know, you need to have that craft honed. But when you're drawing, you have to throw out thinking about it and all that planning out the window and just be loose and draw, because you want the feeling to be free and easy. And, I mean, it sounds like an impossible, like, Zen, you know, puzzle. Tighten up the
How do you
out,
do this?
Yes.
Master Barta. How master do you master Barta. Using... How do you do...
Well, I still haven't figured it out, because I'm still way too tight, but...
You're always working on it.
But that's... Hopefully. But no, I mean, but Carl, you know, he had a goal. He had a goal of some kind of idea of perfection or something. He tried to push you gently in the right direction. And that's what you need when you're young. You need somebody who's encouraging you, but also helping you and giving you technical advice. So,
well,
that helps a lot.
I'm always sort of curious about, you know, when you start off and you've mentioned the fact that at a certain point you sort of liked your work better. You hate you.
I stopped hating it.
You stopped hating it.
I stopped hating it.
You stopped hating your work, and
now I just like it. I just dislike it intensely.
When you're sort of working, you mentioned, you know, like hating your older stuff, and at a certain point you sort of learned to like not hate it. Is there ever like a palpable sense of balancing, like especially being a freelance artist when you get something? And you were talking earlier about like deadlines. Is it ever like an issue where you? You know, a lot of people say you never finish like a piece of art, you just walk away from
sacrifice
it. Is that something you have to
sacrifice
learn?
At some point?
Yeah. As a friend of mine used to say, it is done, therefore it is good.
Yeah, is that like something you have to teach yourself to like sort of accept?
Well, if you're going to be a professional and you want to get another job, I have missed some deadlines. I have blown some deadlines big time, and you know, you get hell to pay for it. You know, and there are a lot of people who are really talented artists, and I remember somebody used to tell a story about Alan Weiss. A guy, his work would come in to the office at Marvel, and all these guys would be really pissed off. Alan Weiss in the 70s was pretty young, and he'd just lovingly and laboriously render all this detail into his pages. Realistic anatomy by comic book standards, you know, subtle expressions and things. And the old guys would be like, oh, man, now we're all going to have to do this, you know, because there's a certain style that developed in comics shorthand and developed for a reason, because you have to, you know, you have to meet deadlines and make a living. And you know, there's all these guys that came in, I was describing that sort of second or third or whatever generation it is. They grew up loving comics, and they were there because they loved it, not because it was just a living. And they were bringing a little something else to the table. And eventually that paid off for them. And guys like Wrightson, you know, had a hard time doing a monthly book. I mean, he kept Swamp Thing going for a long time. But, you know, when you're putting that kind of work... It's really hard to do a monthly comic. It's just hard to maintain those standards.
Was it like a case where sometimes we... I mean, obviously when you start off and like you walk in with your
portfolio...
I have
walked away... When you're inking, you get it done.
Yeah, and you walk
away. And it's out the
it.
Door. I mean, I have put pages into FedEx boxes where the ink is literally wet and I'm blowing on it. And I'm like, can you wait a minute more? And no, you're just putting pages into the box, wet ink, and sealing it up, going, please. And you put like a photocopy in between the pages so they don't bleed
on
each
other. So it doesn't bleed in. Is that something that you went in right away, like, or is that something where you're like, oh, I don't want it. I mean, obviously it must be painful sometimes.
Well, it's always a matter of, you know, I'll spend my time on this, I won't spend my time on that, whatever, but you have to find a balance. I don't think I've ever found it. I don't draw a regular comic because of that.
Mike?
Guys like Mike Norton, people who do regular, you know, books on schedule, I'm always astonished by that because I can't do that.
We've been joined, or Mike has joined us. Mike came into the shop, and it's very timely. Mike, you were a freelancer for a very long time, and just recently you've been signed to an exclusive contract with DC. And you have a reputation of being a guy that's never late. You're usually always either on time or ahead of schedule, and listening to Hillary, you know, with that balance of just trying to get it done or sacrificing. I mean, what are your feelings on that end of it as far as like...
That's the only way you can be on time, quite frankly. I mean, seriously, I wish I could be... I have friends who sit and they... I don't know the details of their projects and stuff, but it seems like they take a lot more time than I do to do a page, and I'm extremely jealous of what they're able to produce. And I get mine done just because I'm I think it's a mental thing. I think it's like an OCD. I have to get. I can't break a record. You know, I have to.
Yeah, have to get.
Have
it done.
To get it yeah. done. And it kind of drives you like crazy. Like nobody wants to be around you, or you're. In my case, I'm just whiny to the point where people are just saying, "Shut the hell up." You know, I can't.
You're compelled to make the deadline. Is
yeah,
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great compulsion there.
I
mean, if you're going to have a problem, that's a good problem
well,
to have.
It came... I mean, I was like that when I was doing... not even doing comics, but when I was just doing illustration freelance for advertising and stuff. I don't know if it was beat into me by whoever it was I was working for. I had a lot of friends in the Memphis advertising industry, the big booming Memphis advertising industry. But you're not late there. You stay up
until it's done.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, I used to work at an agency, and you know there were it was common. We're staying here. It's Friday. We're staying. We're staying until it's done. We
yeah,
don't
I
even
mean,
have the job yet. This is like for a proposal. Doesn't matter. You want to get paid. You want to get fired. Yeah, you know, you got to stay. So I mean, I think that had a lot to do with it, and. I think on a personal level, I think maybe I need to see a shrink because I can't not do it.
Just you know what? This is Hillary, and again, let me just tell you, it's a good problem to have.
Well, no,
because there are 1,000 reasons for being late. You
right.
found a good reason for right. being on time.
Right.
I'd say just live with it.
I'm living. I mean,
be happy you're not one of us.
There are advantages. I admit. I mean, people always like you, but. There are also advantages to, I mean, even if you, I mean, forget the people that are like years late on stuff, but the guys who never hit the deadline but are fantastic, those are the guys you always hear about because, well, they're fantastic.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's always a give and take.
And at the same time, drawing, say, if we're talking about detail or whatever, I mean, whatever makes it take more time, it doesn't necessarily make it better that you spent more time on it.
No.
Jack Kirby was a great artist, and spontaneity is part of what made him great, that energy that came from that. Trying to get energy over spending 20 days on a page trying to capture that energy probably wouldn't work.
Right.
But at the same time, guys like Jim Lee are not going to be out of work because they're late on All-Star.
That's sort of what I mean.
You know, or whatever.
I mean by that, I mean, those guys...
Yeah,
those guys are always gonna. It can be frustrating.
The publishers sacrifice that because
right.
of their names.
Now more than ever, obviously.
Right.
Well, when guys are sitting waiting around for a year for comics and stuff like
well,
that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Hillary. Is it more prevalent now?
I don't think the problems that we're talking about even existed when I was a kid in the 1960s and before. People just weren't late. If they
right.
were late, they didn't work. Well, that's it.
That
it didn't
it.
Work.
We'll find somebody
right.
else to
you,
do it.
You drew a monthly comic, you draw a monthly comic. And there were very few guys, I mean, you know, a few artistes probably, you know, that, like, they, you know, they would draw an occasional issue of things.
Who's calling Mike Norton?
Dan DiDio.
But that, I think, to be honest with you, I think that started in the same period I'm talking
drawing?
About. It started in the 1970s when
right.
you had this generation of artists who grew up loving comics and they wanted to do it because they loved the art form and they thought of themselves as artists. And, oh, my name signed to this is a big deal. It wasn't like the people didn't care about what they did before. They were perfectionists.
It was less interchangeable. Well, like, the pieces become less...
Well, at the same...
I just think that the mentality of somebody wanting to make it the best comic book ever, whatever, just those problems, if you want to call it a problem, that became magnified during that period.
Listen to a roundcomics.com podcast new every Monday. For once, you won't be lying to your parents when you tell them you're not looking at porn.
Let's talk a little bit about more about the relationship between an editor and a freelance artist. What's that process like? How does that work from, you know, the beginning of a script and getting the work done? I mean, is it, you know, we've heard a lot of stories of, you know, it's just like an editor's job is just to constantly scream at an artist until they get the work done. Is that pretty much it?
One inker at Marvel in the old days was famous for procuring prostitutes for the editorial staff. And that's how he got a lot of work, apparently.
No way. Are you serious? I mean, seriously?
Even though we're talking about people that are no longer alive, I don't want to mention names.
Well, sure.
Just because, you know, I think there was mob influence here, so I don't want to, you know. I just don't want to even.
Just want a horse's head.
That's an embarrassment.
All my quarter books are going to get burned.
That sounds like an urban legend because it doesn't seem like it would be cost. Like the return on investment
cost,
there.
Cost efficient.
Well, yeah, I mean,
no,
it's like,
I didn't say he paid for
them. Unless these are really. Oh, they just. Was this an ink or pimp? Are we talking about? Like,
Sal, don't forget that comic books literally were created on the backs of these publishers of softcore porn.
All right. Well,
there were guys. There were guys who would like would.
Same
would
guys.
There were guys who were pulling scams because they had to pay off their gambling debts. You know, artists and. There's all sorts of crazy stories about how guys got work or something they're holding over an editor's head. That's all the colorful, fanciful side.
Sure.
The truth of it is, you get hired for a couple reasons. You have a relationship with your editor, you know, you can be friends, you know, you have some kind of professional thing that really works. And there's a reason for them hiring you for commercial reasons. You're popular, they think you can sell the book. So somewhere in between those two, that's how you get work, right? They want to hire you because they like you, they can trust you, meeting the deadline, as we're talking about.
Right.
Or the publisher's like, nah, we're not hiring that guy anymore. We're going to hire this guy. I mean, you know, you're popular. You sell books.
Have you run into that issue of, like, you know, for whatever reason, all of a sudden you're sort of blacklisted or somebody just doesn't like you and...
Oh, sure. No, my art style is not going to... you're not going to see me draw on a mainstream Marvel or DC book, even if I could meet the deadline, even if that wasn't the issue. They're not going to hire me because my stuff's too cartoony, right? So that's out. Whereas, say, in the 1940s, there were cartoony adventure strips. Mm-hmm. And even today there are. I mean, things have broken down. There's a range of styles now. But you're sort of middle-range Marvel DC wouldn't involve my kind of cartoony. It would involve certain specific type of cartoony influences. Manga, for instance, became acceptable. They'll tell you, oh, we don't hire cartoony anymore. But, manga isn't cartoon.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, I mean, I know you've talked in the past where, you know, you've had issues of people thinking of your style.
Yeah, I've intentionally actually gone the opposite direction because of what Hillary's saying.
Oh,
yeah. Because, I mean, even though it's weird because I was talking about this with somebody the other day, the general editorial consensus will say one thing, but the work will kind of say something else. You know, people will say all day we don't like... You know, cartoony, but then you'll look at 1,500 books that, that say otherwise.
Well, you look at what sells too,
right? And exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I grew up drawing like cartoony, and I was doing that. And I didn't grow up, but I started drawing cartoony professionally. That's what I was doing. And I would get comments just like we don't want to make their eyes too big and stuff like that. And
I draw the heads too big.
Oh really?
At First Comics they used to photostat them and shrink them down and paste them
your
up.
Heads.
Oh really?
Wow.
Yeah, I have.
Hillary's got a huge head.
I've got a huge head.
It's that reference of using a mirror. It's
what's the problem? Come on.
It looks natural to me.
I don't. Came from Easter Island. Come on.
Anyway,
not
that you do.
That goes back to sort of like, you know, you get known for a certain thing, and it's very hard to get out of that, you know, get that out of editors' heads, I'd imagine, of being able to change. Even if you know you can do...
I mean, I think I've seen people that manage to change, but yeah, I mean, you do get... I mean, we don't think of Mike for this sort of thing.
Right.
You know, I'm sure it's same for Hillary. I mean, but...
Yeah.
Well, what I'm always curious about is, are you ever conscious of, like... the style that you have? Like, at some point when someone says, oh, you draw, like, this way, and all of a sudden you look at it and you're like, wait, I do, but I never thought of that before that.
There are moments like that. I don't know if it's happened to you, but people have pointed something out, and I didn't quite realize that I was that influenced. Because I see my own work as a collection of influences. You know, I grew up studying different artists, wanting to draw like these guys, and then those influences are all there in one form or another in my work, so I... And when people tell me, "Oh, no, I can always recognize your inking," I don't know how they can do that.
Oh, I can.
Yeah, see, and I don't. I think of it as, "Oh, this is just some weird mix of all, like, oh, I'm doing this Wally Wood head, or this one looks more like, you know, Joe Sin."
I wonder if anybody can actually recognize that then, because I mean,
do they see their own work as a uniform? Yeah. I don't see my work as a. Yeah, maybe I see it as a uniform thing.
Style.
But that uniform thing is a made up of different.
It's not entirely
right,
yours.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't think of it as entirely mine.
You're thinking of the influences rather than what is actually in the
book. Yeah, like. When I look at it, I kind of go, oh, yeah, that's a little that's a little like this or a little like that or something. Yeah.
Well, I can't.
Did you draw a pinup for Dr. Goyle? Or
I co-created Dr. Goyle.
That's right. Yeah, okay, I just remember. I was trying to remember where. Yeah, that's probably the first time I saw your name.
Yeah. Well, it's the first time I saw it.
Because I knew Stegbauer,
yeah.
So did we met back then?
We never met back then, but yeah. I yelled at Stegbauer for getting people that could draw the character better than me in the book. I mean, that was seriously when I was starting out, and it was probably some of the worst stuff I've ever done. And then you look at these pinups in the back, and it's like, you should have gotten these guys to draw the book.
Yeah. This, of course, is the same guy who I showed up at the convention, and the pinup I had drawn for him was on a T-shirt he was wearing. I said,
yeah.
You put it on a T-shirt? He goes, oh, yeah. I said, well, is there one for me? He's like, I don't
You couldn't even get a T-shirt.
Well, I'm like, you know. It's like some guy did some mini comic art for a guy. He just draws for free. It's just like these little comics, you know, they sell for a buck through the mail. And then he keeps putting it on mugs that he's trying to sell.
Cafe Press.
I'm like, you can't do that without asking me.
Right.
He goes, I don't understand. I'm just promoting the book. Well, then ask me first, and I'll tell you whether you can using my artwork. You never paid me for the art, did you? You know what that little C in a circle means? It's
like, oh, man, I'm going to have to take all those Spider-Man shirts of something like that.
You'd be surprised. I see some of that stuff.
Anyway, okay, good. No, I placed you in it. I was like, where did I first hear you? Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, I'm not judging you by that. I don't.
Oh, thank you. Please don't.
Hey, I spent. Were you here while I'm talking about my early work? It's all embarrassing.
You know, that's more artists that, you know, and over the last year or so, we've talked to a lot of different artists and creators and at conventions and stuff, and it's like, you guys are all. You have one unifying thing about all of you is you hate your own stuff. You guys, you're like the most self-deprecating, like, you can't stand your own work. And I guess, you know, I can understand it to a certain degree, but it's like at some point, you know, are you ever happy with the work that you produce? Are you ever, is there ever...
You're going to have moments of going, oh, yeah, that turned out. Yeah. But the thing that I'm happiest about are things, you know, inking is something, like, when you're doing it right, it happens. Almost by magic, right? A line will happen, and you go, it's better than I thought, or your hand just jumps to the place you wanted to jump without thinking about it. Because when you're thinking about it, you're controlling your hand from doing what it would do naturally. So when it works right is when you're not thinking about it. And can you imagine me not thinking about it?
I'm
overanalyzing everything. So I'm hardly ever in that place. But the guys who do it, it's a spontaneous thing. So it sort of happens, and you have to kind of, I don't know. I've gotten into discussions with people just about imagination in general, you know, because people are saying, oh, the idea just came to me. Well, like, do you take credit for something that just comes out of the ether, you know, comes out of the...
Right.
Where does it come from? How does it occur to you?
It's the sum of your own references and experiences.
Yeah, happy is your question, and yes, I'm not saying I'm never happy. It doesn't last for long.
it's no different than any other performance art where you know where you accidentally jerked and that line was wrong, and that might be the memory you have of X-Men 28.
The reason,
and even though the rest of the book is great, that's what sticks out for you, because I know that's the way it is for TV and radio whenever I've done productions and stuff, and I'll fall into a happy accident, as you say, where you just let your mind kind of relax, and that's where the interesting things happen, and you can take credit for those and be proud of those.
Spontaneity.
Yes, exactly.
Well, the reason I kind of bring it up is that, you know, when we talked about this a little bit earlier, is that unlike almost any other industry, this industry's fan base is built of so many people that want to be in the industry, that
almost
want to either
exclusively.
Oh yeah,
not me, man.
That's why I like you so much.
But, like, not everybody that uses plumbing wants to be a plumber.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, and the,
I did when I was.
The interesting thing is that, you know, it's like, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a comic book artist, and obviously didn't work out. But I've, you know, it's like I've read every book there is about drawing comics. I've, you know, gone to classes. I've gone, you know, I've listened, I've talked to every, you know, artist, and it's like, you cannot really answer the question of how to be a comic artist or an artist in general. It's and it goes back to what you're saying, is it's those moments of spontaneity that you don't even know how to answer that question. And it's amazing. You'll go to like conventions and they'll have these panels, and guys will be talking about, you know, how to write a comic or how to draw a comic, or and they can give you the technical information about it, but that leap from that to actually producing something that other people enjoy is, there's no path that you can follow to get there. Everybody's path is different, and it's just such an interesting thing to me, because I've tried to follow. My brain works in the way it's like, okay, if you give me a step-by-step guide to doing something, yeah, I can do it. Yeah. But, you know, like getting to the point where you guys have become, you know, successful comic artists, and you produce these amazing works that I personally look at and just, I can't imagine ever doing. It's like, you know, you cannot tell someone how to get there. And I'm sure you both have probably
been asked. No, I actually disagree in one sense. That I think almost anyone who talks about artists, they say there's talent, but then you have to develop it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
that's craft, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, learning, how do you develop it? And what's, you know, what's the talent based on? We're saying it's your influences and what you do with it, right?
Right.
You know, hardly anybody springs from nowhere. I think you can be an artist and not be articulate or intellectual or whatever about what you do. You just draw really well.
Well, your mind accepts your mind might accept the concepts that, you know, you can read the technical manual, but that doesn't mean you necessarily understand it. Without even understanding it on a conscious level, something clicks in your mind and you're able to make it happen. And I think a lot of teaching is really just learning craft.
Well,
and
certainly,
and that becomes the conduit where the talent can either come through or not.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's no different than music.
That was sort of kind of what I was trying to say. I guess, sure, I just didn't get to the point. Was that it's only about how hard you work at it. It's like you're not going to find an answer in a book. You're not going to find that answer in
a panel at a convention. Right, though, American comics. I mean, the thing about it is that in terms of instruction, American comics traditionally have had a rather poor academic tradition with the art. You know, our artists are more kind of by the seat of their pants. They learn how to draw comics by looking at comics. And in Europe, they have a better academic tradition. They go to schools where they teach you technical drawing. And they learn the technical things that then you can bring your imagination and creativity to. Now Mike's going to talk because I keep talking. And,
you know. No.
You're 100% correct about everything, Mr. Barda.
Mr. Barda.
Mr. B.
See, I think I did suffer from too much ego early on when I was no good. I was like, I got there because I was blind to my faults, probably, because I would like do it. I'd just stumble into it and think, oh, I can do this. And look at that. Isn't that great? I'm doing it. And then I, like years later, as you start maturing or something, whatever that process is called, you realize, God, I was terrible.
Yeah,
was terrible.
I think it's true, but I think that's almost weird if it's in doing like improv in the city and also doing accounting, which is a funny way to tie this in together.
Very creative
process.
When people
first come into anything, they don't like to be told that they're not doing something correctly or that they could do something better, and that it takes a little while for people to start to mature to accept to be like, I can improve, I can like take criticism. So I think taking criticism is something that up until you sort of get your job at doing what you do, you're never really taught how to take criticism.
Well, you may never be able to take criticism, but self-criticism.
Yeah.
You know, being realistic and being able to assess your own abilities and stuff. And
you know, that brings up...
That's different. I mean, it's...
That brings up something I wonder how you guys feel about, is that...
Do you like me?
Yeah, how do you feel about me as a
person?
Well,
for an accountant, you're not too bad.
I'm wondering.
What's it like what's it like hearing criticism from the people that buy the books and read the books? And what is that... How does that affect you? Does it affect you guys in any way? Does it, you know, change how you approach working on books? Does it, you know, I mean...
Well, not everybody knows what they're talking about. So not every opinion is equally valid, contrary to what a lot of people out there like Oprah would have you think. Not everybody is equal in their opinion.
Sponsored by Oprah.
It's all about being informed, you know. I mean, you know, just because someone doesn't like your art doesn't mean if somebody who I admired didn't like my art, it would hurt me probably, right? I'd think, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. He understands art.
Right.
However, if you...
thanks.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just
with that, we have to leave Hillary. And no.
Going back a second, I'm curious.
I didn't mean that. I really didn't.
Have you guys ever compared notes to people who have had more formal training, Kubert School graduates or the School of Visual Arts in New York? I mean, there are some schools that are representative in the comics industry where you are being taught by, you know, Mazzucchelli, and you're being taught by the Kuberts and all the various guys. So that, I mean, they're teaching craft. But have you ever compared notes to, like, graduates like that?
I mean, I know people that have gone through those schools, and I know people, you know, they spent the time there, and I've heard from those guys that they got a lot out of it. So, well, I mean,
But in terms of, like, asking them, hey, what are you struggling with? What are you, you know, what things don't... Do you guys ever talk shop like that between each other? Like, you know, do you ever go to Seeley Norton or somebody like that, or Scotty, and say, how would you guys, you know...
Approach this, or
I'm struggling with you harassing.
Well, you're always showing your. I mean, you always show your stuff to another artist. Go, what do you think? You may not articulately, like, you know, you may not say, what do you think about this transition from this sequence? You know, did I handle the, you know, the establishing shot correctly, or is the point of view carried through? But you just go, do you like it, or what works for you? And I, friends, you know, that objective eye, whoever was talking about before, somebody gives you, you know, like, will point out something you hadn't thought about your own work. That happens.
Yeah.
You can, someone can bring you outside of your perspective and say, oh, look at that. You see it for the first time that way. And it's a, you know, it can open your eyes to something you were too close to see.
I do it every day. I probably send out every page I finish to one or two guys I know and see, is this okay? Before I send it off to somebody. So
going back to the criticism, not from, you know, peers, but from the fan base.
Back to criticism.
Well, no, because it interests me as far as, you know, because I'm simply just a fan. I'm not in the industry at all. So I wonder, especially nowadays with the internet and how much that has given a voice to so many more people. I mean, it used to be, you know, letter pages. You know, that's how you said how you felt about
if they were printed.
If they were printed. Now it's you can go to any message board and find out, you know, Google your name and, you know, whatever, and you'll find out what people think. Yeah, well, maybe he'll...
I did Google myself once, and there was someone asking if Hillary was a girl or not, or somebody was correcting somebody. saying, no, Hillary's a guy, you know, whatever.
Damn.
So, yeah, that I've heard, you know. Real life, I get that, and on the internet. So.
But
I can't escape it.
Is it something that, you know, you are leery about? Is it something you look out for? Is it something that you even care about? Is it something that you're, you know, even conscious of?
I am conscious of it, and I mean, I'm not ashamed. Well, maybe I am ashamed to admit that I mean, I do pay attention to that stuff. I don't think I can help it. You know?
Right. How could you not?
I'd like to see if people actually like the work I'm doing. I do have to keep in mind, and I've actually had conversations about this too, is that the internet is not necessarily always the best gauge of how you're doing. Because, I mean, they are the vocal minority.
Right.
You know, not everybody on the internet are the people buying the comics in the first place. You know?
Sure.
And in the old days, the guys writing the letters were not your average reader. Right. They were the obsessed
fans.
They're the
ones that actually took the time out to write a letter and mail it and, like, find the address, that kind of stuff.
Not many people wrote letters that said, you are the suck.
Exactly.
T-E-H, the suck.
I inked Power Pack for a number of years. And I inked a few different artists on that book, John Bogdanov for the most part, but also June Bridgman, who's you know, she draws Brent Starr now.
Oh, cool.
And anyway, it was this fan whose name I will not mention, but he wrote a letter every month, and it would go on. You know, I think the letters had to be edited down because they were longer than the letters column, but he wrote letter after letter after letter. He wanted to write the book. He kept, you know, he would go in detail about all the storylines.
So I would write scene one.
But he was also hung up about the artist, and he didn't like John Bogdanov, who was the regular artist in the book. And he did profess to like June Bridgman, who did the occasional fill-in.
Right.
So they screwed up the, accreditation on one of the books, and an issue drawn by John was credited as June, and vice versa, and, you know, it was screwed up on a page. And he wrote in a letter, see what I was telling you? See how much better she is than John.
Right.
That's John.
And they were so happy because in print they were able to say, I'm sorry, but we made a mistake and it was actually John. I mean, but this guy he couldn't even recognize the difference between the two artists.
Yeah.
And they don't really draw alike. And
yeah, I mean,
so what, you know, it's the opinion. What does the opinion matter?
Exactly,
it's whoever is speaking.
Yeah.
Well, it's like one person who's incredibly loud seems like a thousand, you know.
Of course.
Like, you know, much more than
you're
like.
You're going to always remember the negative stuff anyway, I mean, over the positive.
Because if you like something, like, not. I think it's like a cultural thing of like, if I really like something, I may not necessarily go around and be like, hey, I love this, you know, like, I love this,
well,
you know.
Yeah, you, there's that old saying that if you're doing some. I mean, they're only going to complain if you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
so.
Though, I mean, I think. Getting on a letters page used to be pretty easy if you told them how much you liked it. I mean, they wanted to print more.
There was an editorial involved.
They'd print more letters like that no matter what was going on.
Of course.
But the fact is, we're artists. We have an ego. We're like anybody. If you were a painter and someone said they didn't like, you know, the wall you just painted, or they did, I mean,
someone
one would hurt you and one would make you feel good. And then we're the same way. You want to hear positive feedback.
Someone doesn't like a tax return I prepare.
But this is very different from going into a comic store and asking comic fans, what do you like? What do you like? You know, do you like this page? Do you like that page? And then basing your style on what the comic fans.
Well, people buy shit that they don't even
read.
Said,
which is what one very successful comic artist did once.
So there you go.
You're going to have to tell me who that was.
One of the founders of Image Comics.
No, really? You have so many skeletons.
Skeletors.
What?
You spend enough time at bars at comic conventions.
I'm working on it.
You have plenty of Skeletors in your closet.
Skeletors.
That's Tim Seeley.
What? What do you think is the biggest, you know, difference in the industry now as opposed to when you first started?
There's more comics. There were a lot less. I mean, back in the 40s, there were a lot of comics. But in the 60s, I mean, you had Marvel and DC, and then there would always be some company trying to compete with them. Then you had Archie and Disney and, you know, Gold Key. You had a few companies that never quite sold as well as the Marvel and DCs did when they were at their peak. But, I mean, Disney's did fine. But you've just got... I mean, I'm just looking at the racks around us in the store. I can't keep up with the amount of comics. Marvel didn't publish hundreds of comic books. It just I don't know how many comics come out from Marvel in a week now, but or DC.
I think a month, it's like 80 a month, isn't it?
Wow, I don't know.
I think it is like 80.
And I remember
80.
Looking at
which
the
is down from a few years ago.
And you look at when I, you know, first started reading comics was, you know, early to mid 60s, and the checklist would be one. It'd be like there was there were four or five books at the beginning, right? And then there were seven books, and then all of a sudden there were 25 and 50. You know, you can't possibly. You could have read all the Marvel comics very easily in those days. You could read them all, and the DCs, and probably do it on your... Well, maybe you could do it on your my allowance wasn't that good. So.
Well, don't forget, too, back in the Silver Age, Marvel was having that distribution problem and had to get their books through DC, through National, and were only allowed, like, 16 books, you know, if that. And that's why you had... Tales of Suspense, where you had both Iron Man and Captain America together.
They wanted to put two characters
on it. Right, right. So.
This is Richard Starkings, and I'm just here to say that 9 out of 10 Elephant Men prefer to listen to Around Comics.
Can you talk about what you're currently drawing, or is that top secret stuff?
No. Actually, I'm working once again with Bongo Comics. Brian Posehn and Jerry Duggan wrote a... story for Bart Simpson's Treehouse of Horror, so I'm drawing another one of those.
That's great, man.
And the thing was, is it came in, and I couldn't turn it down, and I've got some other work already on the table, so I'm trying to juggle a few things. So, yeah.
Bongo is awesome. It really is.
Oh, yeah.
And I think really one of the unsung publishers in comics, because that stuff, man, you know, because we're not that far apart in age. Think of all the licensed cartoon stuff that used to come out in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
It was crap. And The Simpsons is so much better, and it really is consistent with the voice of the actual animated shows.
Did you not read that Jetsons comic where Rosie strangled Astro?
No, and there was charm. Don't get me wrong. There really was charm to the Flintstones and some of the Hanna-Barbera adaptations in its own way. And you had good artists on the books and stuff like that, but the scripts were just kind of blah. I don't remember anything that was as consistent, you know.
Well, we don't have to put down, you know, previous comics to praise Bongo. Bongo's just great, and today there aren't
John.
Too many good. No,
don't
I'm
be
not,
stupid.
No, he's
no,
cool.
I just
you're cool.
What's great is that they're doing mostly humor, I mean, they do some non-humor. They publish a few other things besides Simpsons stuff.
Really?
Well, they, yeah. They,
I didn't realize
they
that.
They do some creator-owned stuff.
I had no idea.
True. Maybe it's a different branch of the company. It's not Bongo.
No, I'd take your word for it, but go ahead.
Am I wrong?
I don't think so. No, I don't know off the top of my head,
but I know they've done a number of things over the years.
In the past, they've done.
Yeah, I just thought they like not only the comic books, but they publish everything tied to the Simpsons and Futurama and all the graining creations.
Yeah, and they kept Futurama alive when Fox was kicking them around.
Absolutely.
And it's still going strong as a comic.
And soon to be a direct-to-video movie.
Yep.
And of course, the Simpsons movie coming out this summer.
Hot.
Really? There's a Simpsons movie coming out?
Yeah.
You didn't know that?
I did not know that.
So. Really? Oh, we saw. They
is
showed
it live
like,
action or?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Starring Bruce Willis as Homer.
Yeah, exactly. No, Michael Chiklis will be Homer.
Go.
The entire thing looks like that Homer in the Twilight Zone episode of The Simpsons. 3D.
Yes. Yeah, that was actually very cool.
That was
I love that.
When he walks in the erotic cake bakery at the end, and then he's fine.
Anyway, yeah, no, I love Bongo. Even if I didn't work for him, it's not but no, they're good people, and
cool.
they're giving me another chance to screw something new up. So,
hey, nice going on the Romita tribute.
Oh, thank you, sir.
That was really cool. That was really, really cool.
I did want to talk about that a little bit, because I know when I talked to you about that initially, and this is something I wanted to find out from you about. In the process of working on comics for Marvel or DC or whoever, whatever publisher it may be. You weren't aware of what that was exactly going to be when it was published.
I had hey, do you want to be a part of this John Romita tribute book?
Right.
So I thought there would be a bunch of stories dealing with John Romita, just like mine. The story I did was written by Neil Gaiman, and
cool.
So then the book came out. I mean, it's not my story, I drew it. Anyway, the book comes out, and it's the only news story in there.
Right.
And there's a bunch of, tributes written by people or, transcribed telephone interviews or whatever they were. But, I just kind of end the checklist, and it was not exactly what I thought, but I didn't ask them what it was. So I was, once again, I assume.
Well, I guess the question is then, I mean, how does that process work as far as, okay, you want to be part of this book, here's a script, or... How did it work out as far as you drawing that book for Neil Gaiman or off of Neil Gaiman?
I think Neil for some reason wanted me to draw it. Neil and I have never met, and he asked the editor to see if I wanted to do it. So I get the call and I say sure, I'd love to do it, and but Neil hadn't written it yet, so I had no idea what it was. Yeah. But I also what we were talking about is I didn't know what the book was really.
Right.
I didn't realize it was the kind of format it was. So.
But you figure
I've done it in any case, and it was still a fun thing to do.
Oh, sure,
it's fun script. And
just trying to understand a little bit of the process more as far as how much information an artist may have going into a project. I mean, as someone that might be, either a signed artist or someone that's under contract for Marvel or DC, opposed to a freelancer when projects come up. Here or there, you're not on a book, on a consistent basis.
Well, yeah. This was a case of deadlines, I think. I mean, if the thing had been written, they just would have sent me the script. If I said, well, let me read it first. Probably, though, in this case, being Neil Gaiman being the writer and the fact that I hadn't worked for Marvel since I was part of that Clash Action lawsuit, which I probably shouldn't talk about. That'll help me get me work at Marvel.
Skip over that,
No, I mean, it was, it's water under the bridge. A lot of painful, expensive water under the bridge. But, I got the call, and I would have done it in any case. But it hadn't been written, and they were telling me, it's going to have to get drawn on a pretty tight deadline here because the book's coming up. And I'm like, but it's not written yet. So I agreed to do it, and then they gave me a little extra time because the thing came in almost on the date it was due. It was so late that I got the contract. I had to fax them the contract back. Because they were going to press that day, and they couldn't go to press until I had signed the contract.
Wow.
So, the art had already been drawn before I even, they probably don't even want me to be talking about that in public. Because technically now I own Stan Lee's head, because I drew it before I signed the contract.
Nice.
Yeah. All right.
So if they ever make a movie about that,
you go.
It's all yours, man.
You worked with some pretty big names.
Plus, I guess I own J.R. Jr. now, too, because I drew him before I signed the contract.
There you go.
So, man, I think I could probably get more money for him than Stanley's head. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Commission Randy Bowen and get him making some statues and stuff. So
a mini, a Stanley mini bust. An original Hillary Butter creation, Stan Lee's head.
Shay, look at that. It looks just like
that. Actually ties in with Bongo, because I did kind of as a nod to all those floating Bongo heads, you know, the head in the jar kind of thing. So. Like Al Gore's head and
Spock.
They did everybody. Yeah.
Oh, we're all going to end up with the jar.
Senator was in there.
Yeah.
Marv Albert.
So Neil Gaiman, Alan...
Not in the same one, though.
Probably.
Yes.
Probably, actually.
Oh, God.
I love that show.
Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore, you've worked some pretty big names in comics. How do you...
John Ostrander's even... It's even a bigger name.
Yeah.
That is physically a bigger name, yes, yeah, indeed.
It's a larger name.
It's a good Scrabble name, absolutely.
It's always written in bold. It's heavier in all ways.
I'm sorry, I'm too silly.
We love
silly.
Jack. No, yeah. Jack, that's right. Doing the Grimjack and London's Bar stuff.
And they're doing Grimjack again now.
I'm
talking to Doug Rice, and they're doing. He's going to be doing a Munden's Bar story.
Excellent,
ooh,
fantastic.
Which I would love to do. And officially, saying that.
Throwing that out there.
Wink, wink.
On the whatever this is, it's not air. What is this? Distilled atmosphere here.
Magic. Distilled magic.
Munden's Bar, based on a great bar that used to be on Cicero Avenue. Did you ever go to the Bucket of Suds?
Of course.
That a boy, Joe Danilo.
He lived there.
I was in the Bucket of Suds once. And the guy,
John Ostrander stabbed.
No, I was there with Ostrander and a few other people.
Sure.
And I had my back to the bar, and the guy sitting right behind me, about a foot away, his head kind of lobbed back on the chair, and he died, like a foot away from me.
Oh, wow.
And it was like one of the weirdest things. Of course, it was horrible. You know, a friend's wife who was a nurse was trying to give him, you know, mouth to mouth and all this stuff. But when the paramedics got there, they said there was nothing we could have done. He was dead on the spot. But, yeah, it was just like... And then you're sitting in a bar, of course, and we're all, like, drinking and eating pizza. And then we're like, okay, so...
You finish your drink.
And Joe was like, well...
what do you have?
He didn't kick us out. Right? Joe had nowhere to go. And this is one of his... This is an old friend of his.
Wow.
But apparently he'd been a lifelong drinker. He probably strained himself over the years. But he was dry. He'd been sober for many years. And was just sitting there drinking a pop and passed out.
Wow.
You know.
Man.
Yeah.
All right, last call. All right, who's
that was the weird
seven
thing.
Another.
Is that uncomfortable, like, 20 minutes afterwards, we're wondering what we should do for Joe, because it was his friend, and, you know, we're like, you know, we didn't even want to leave, you know?
Joe Dano, a real Chicago personality, was the jazz philosopher on Chicago Public Radio for many years, in addition to owning
the Bucket of Suds,
which... I'm telling you, man, it was right around the corner from WXRT, and that was my
hangout
for there.
For the XRT people.
And the theater crowd went there, the comics crowd went there, and because John straddled both of those worlds, Ostrander, I think, and also Del Close.
Yeah,
and those,
Del Close,
and those guys, and Mike Grell would always hang out there. And then when they were filming The Color of Money, Scorsese and company all hung out at the Bucket.
I ran across an interview with you online that somebody had done, and in it was an interesting discussion about Watchmen. And I think they had asked you the question because this was around the time when Splash Brannigan first came around.
Yeah.
And they asked you about your feelings on Watchmen. I thought your answer was interesting. I don't want to put you on the spot. Like,
yeah,
what
but
was
this
your
is
answer?
Like Tim Russert and Meet the Press. You're going to read it to me now, right?
No, I'm not going to read it to you.
When it says
no, honestly,
I have the North Star letter.
I don't remember the quote.
Dick.
No. To paraphrase your answer was, you felt a lot of the... While obviously Watchmen's a great comic and a great read, you had also thought that you agreed with Alan Moore's opinion about it, that it in some way had done a bit more damage to the... Or as much damage to the industry as it had done good things for the industry.
Right. I mean, I think Alan has, you know... I think Alan's uncomfortable. He's just uncomfortable with praise in general, right? I mean, he likes to say, you know, he's just another writer out there working hard.
Sure.
So he's uncomfortable. But I think in that case, he didn't like that people were trying to do dark stuff because they thought Watchmen was cool and, you know, Rorschach was this cool character. So all these characters came about that were trying to do this sort of nasty take on comics characters. And he, you know, I think he felt pretty bad about that. But I think he once said something like, well, Watchmen was just another comic book, and it wasn't that big of a deal. He didn't know why people were all that excited.
Impressed by it.
Which is I'm not going to call it false modesty, but right. I honestly think he is a modest person in that he doesn't want to toot his own horn, so he's uncomfortable.
But I just thought it was interesting because I kind of, you know, you see obviously just sort of the dominoes fall after Watchmen, and how everybody, I think, and like I said, I'm sure you don't remember saying it, but one of the things you had said was, so many people afterwards were trying to emulate that as opposed to coming up with something original. You know, it's like everybody was just trying to do the next Watchmen as opposed to doing something more original. And I think that, you know, really speaks to what we saw for years and years and still see to some degree. Mm-hmm. Not nearly as much, but we saw for years and years and years just people trying to do the next Watchmen. And it really, while it's no fault of Alan Moore's, obviously, he just wrote a comic that everybody tried to, you know, that was good enough that everyone wanted to emulate.
But I think he was reacting to the sort of dark, kind of pessimistic side, and he certainly has proved that that's not all he's about.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to Watchmen, he wrote just absolutely wonderful Superman stories that are a hoot, and since almost all the stuff at the ABC stuff
is sort of almost
like an answer to sort of, you know, what he saw as negatives in comics. He was of it was kind of old fashioned fun, but it was just fun in general.
Yeah, Jack B. Quick. Yeah. I mean, obviously Splash. I mean, you know, especially American's
when
Best
I
Comics. Tomorrow Stories.
When I had stopped reading comics for a little while, and the only thing I was getting was The Flash, because I always got The Flash. It was actually the Tom Strong books that got me back into reading more and more stuff.
Those are wonderful books.
Yeah.
They're like the most, they're the completely most like distilled stuff of what's great about old comics, but it kind of sheds away, I think, a lot of, if you pick up like an old comic, you might get like a weird, you know, like the Fantastic Four, like we have to beat the communists to space, and that kind of throws people off sometimes if you kind of, you know, if
a lot of times dialogue is just, whether it's campy,
it takes all the cool stuff out of the like Fantastic Four and all those old comics and just says, this is, you know, how much fun you can have with all these old ideas and all this stuff, and it's still very vital and still works and it can still be an interesting story.
I think the legacy of Watchmen really did extend until like the early 2000s, and I think things like even Infinite Crisis and everything that DC has been trying to do to kind of brighten their universe, because things got so dark. You know, when Batman's back was broken and Superman died, and I mean the entire image boom, all of that came from in the wake of Watchmen, portraying heroes as these grubby, ugly, deconstructive things. You had, you know, the retelling of Green Lantern's origin, where all of a sudden he's a drunk, you know, drunk driving incident, and he's in jail and stuff. And it's like, what does that have to do with Abin Sur? Like, you know,
what
crashing in the desert and, you know, pulling out the ring and everything.
Why?
You know,
yeah, it's just, why with the drunk driving?
But that's what turned me off really from comics in the early 90s. I wasn't really turned on by the whole image craze. I checked out and because I got tired of the Watchmen rehashes and things. And it wasn't until a new bunch of guys in the like 1999 period that they brought me back, you know, and it was guys like Bendis and Brubaker.
Brought you
and
back
guys.
In.
Exactly. Like, much like Michael Corleone.
And once again, because I saw something old, I thought of you, Hillary. Terry and the Pirates, are you a Terry and the Pirates fan? Well, no, I know that he reads a lot of older strip stuff and a lot of older.
You know, I. The last time I saw Terry and the Pirates, actually, I went up to Milwaukee. They had an absolutely, I don't know if you guys made it.
Yes.
It's an absolutely amazing show on. It was on comic strips and it sort of included comic books. It was mostly the history of comic strips. And there, you know, what, the 10 is most essential comics artists of all time, and Kniff was one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And they had just, you know, one original after the other, and it was great. But this show, you could have gone to that show and done weeks just on that show.
Just talking about it.
I just sat in front of, I didn't want to leave. I was only there, unfortunately, for one day, but I wanted to just stay in front of, I mean,
Eisner, forcibly leave,
and,
make you leave.
You know, Kniff, and you go back to Windsor McKay, and all these comic strip artists from the beginning.
Foster.
Well, they're collecting.
Foster was not represented.
They're collecting all the...
Foster was not represented in the show.
Well, I was just going to mention they're collecting all the Terry and the Pirates stuff. IDW's collecting all that.
Just like
so.
They're doing with Dick Tracy.
Yeah,
Peanuts.
And
Peanuts is the other publisher.
Well, Peanuts is Fantagraphics.
Garfield.
But they're doing Terry and the Pirates.
Terry and the Pirates is great. It's a great strip. I mean, you know, strips go on for in the case of something like Terry, I don't know how long that went on for. Is it 20 years?
Until yeah.
Then
well,
you went
well,
just with Steve Canyon in the 50s.
Well, yeah, he... it was
like 30s, 40s.
Actually, it was in the late 40s.
He wrote that pirate craze for a while.
And it was because Tribune wouldn't give him...
The hot pirate comics.
It's like what we make fun of with the Hardy Boys. Like, they're always fighting smugglers. But no, it was. It was great, and it was very contemporary.
Well, once the war was over, they had to kind of fight.
What are they going
to
do? Yeah, but it was a very contemporary strip, much in the same way that Dick Tracy was dealing with gangsters. Terry and the Pirates was international intrigue, and it followed on with Kniff doing Steve Canyon. And, dudes, I'm telling you, it's great stuff, and it holds up. It's fun.
In terms of his art, Kniff, you know, picked up where somebody like Noel Sickles had started this more dramatic approach in comics. It wasn't like it didn't come out of illustration. It was its own unique way of drawing to comics. You know, real bold brushstrokes, use of blacks, and great storytelling. You know, I mean, things that weren't done. You know, big establishing shots that were silent. You know, just showing the scene, because constantly they were traveling to the east, you know, the Far East.
The Far East. The farthest east.
The Orient, they might call it.
The mysterious Orient that we know so little about.
Oh, you know, it would be a scene of a bizarre.
Well, this is what, 1930s, right?
Mid-1930s? Well, yeah, 30s
and 40s.
Yeah,
through the 40s. Yeah.
And it's really a fun... I mean, there's a strip where, you know, it just makes you feel like a boy, you know, a kid again.
Right.
Because it's, like, written from that adventure perspective. Just everything is fun and there's intrigue. And
yeah, Pat Ryan was the adult and Terry was the kid and was kind of the boy sidekick, but really the hero of the story.
And who played the pirates?
lots of people. And, of course, lots they had the dragon lady. The greatest thing in the world, Peter Bogdanovich interviewed Orson Welles, and Orson Welles, as proven by a parody or a little April Fool's joke that Mark Millar played a couple of years ago, huge comics fan.
Orson Welles?
Yes, and had an original painting of the Dragon Lady done by Kniff, and he's like, Kniff was a master and an incredible storyteller.
And what's that wine?
In the same reverence that he had for great filmmakers like John Ford and D.W. Griffith and that is how he spoke of Milton Kniff. And
wow.
Oh, what a master. And really, and Winsor McCay. And he literally is like talking about Winsor McCay and Crazy Cat and Ignatz. Oh, what wonderful, whimsical fairs. Bonnie Google, of course, that was years ago.
But if you like somebody like Alex Toth, people like
sure.
that, it's,
yes.
you know, Kniff is like the pinnacle of that school.
It's interesting, too, because, again, Eisner, Kirby, those guys, they all wanted to be Kniff. Yeah. It's so funny that they are the masters that we all remember, and it's like their Hall of Fame was Foster, Kniff, Sickles, these guys, and that is who they aspired to be. They couldn't get syndicated strips, so they had to kind of settle for comics, you know, back then. Now isn't it interesting how the tide has turned? Because you look at somebody like Frank Cho, who had a decent deal for Liberty Meadows as a syndicated strip. And, you know, really... As newspapers drop like flies, and the comics, I think, you know, only represent 2 to 3 pages of
and
content in the
newspaper. And now it's web comics.
Am I looking at...
Yeah, it's changing.
Ross Andrew or Jerry Grandinetti or somebody like that? I mean, who am I looking at?
You know, that's good. It's too bad this isn't a video, because Thomas pulled out one of his Silver Age comics.
One of his quarter books he bought. Tom, why don't you... For people that weren't here before we started the show... Tom came in today, Mark had pulled aside 4 boxes of new quarter books that he had found, knowing that Tom and John would be more than happy to go through and pull out a lot. And I believe you set a new record for
86 quarter books.
86 quarter books today.
Outstanding.
One of them is Challengers of the Unknown, issue...
71. It has perhaps the greatest letters page.
It has one of the best letters
all
ever.
All three of the letters are...
That would be 15 cents, wouldn't
truly,
it?
15, yeah, 15, okay. Are truly fantastic letters. There's one that is a real standout.
Please.
And, I will do this.
Just save me the ad to subscribe to Grit. Because I'd really
Would you like to buy an issue of Grit, John?
If we were going
to
put a bed of music under this, what would you choose?
That's an interesting question. Good. Yeah, please.
My rights here.
Let's talk about that after I read it, because I think okay. You heard some of it, but you have no idea where it's going, which is Dear editor, and this is a letter to the letter column of Challenger of the Unknown.
What's the letter column called?
Let's Chat with the Chals, which is a little bit of a weak title for the...
Yeah, but they were the Chals back then.
Challenge of the Unknown. Doctor editor. Dear editor, not until I read the letters page in number 69 did I realize why the Challenges of the Unknown is so special to me. I, too, am living on borrowed time, so to speak. Until now, I never considered my experience important. But in the light of the Challenger's brush with death, I look back on it with awe. It occurred about 11 years ago when I was 4 years old. I was playing near our house with some kittens, and for no reason at all, I suddenly rose and strolled over to my mother, who was sitting on the porch. I had only taken a few steps when there was a great crashing of brush, and a full-grown bear ran right over the spot where I had been playing, and continued over the hill until he disappeared.
Where did he live?
If some force hadn't made me move, I'd surely have been crushed. What a harrowing experience! I forget that bear pounding over the spot where I had been a few seconds earlier. Lonnie Thompson, Iron Gate, Virginia.
A.K.A. Bear Man.
Bear Man.
This is just like Bruce Wayne, man. Instead of the bat crashing through, it was the grizzly. I shall be a bear.
I love strike fear.
In all those in the woods. Made me move.
Some force.
He moved. He was a strange. A bear was coming at him, and he moved.
No, it wasn't that simple.
I like that.
Strange. Some force.
He was playing with kittens.
Well, clearly the bear wanted to play with the kittens.
The best part though is the bear isn't attacking anyone. The bear runs by like it's a car driving.
Excuse me.
Not I would have been attacked by the bear, but I would have been trampled by a bear.
So I didn't write a letter to the Challengers of the Unknown about it, but I was hit by a bear in the face once.
Really?
This is a
like closed fist.
This is a true story. It's
are
not
you playing with kittens.
No, but I was working on my pull list at the time.
Obviously, see that strange force didn't make you move out of the way of that bear.
Well, what it was is we were at I think it was Yellowstone. Me and my family, and we were in a VW bus, and they had the sliding door at the time.
Sure.
And on that sliding door was a window that worked on a hinge. It would open by turning, not by rolling down.
Was it a bubble window?
No. Okay. It's like a vertically rectangle. Anyway,
go ahead.
The bear. You know, they've been telling us don't feed the bears, don't feed the bears when you were entering the park, and so we weren't going to feed the bears. And ahead of us were people like shaking cereal boxes out the window. The bears.
Leaving them a trail.
The bears are just sitting there. There's like two or three bears just sitting there, you know, getting food from cars. So we're like, my mom's like, roll up the windows, close the window. So we close, you know, the windows were closed except for this little vent window, which I'm thinking it's a little vent window,
right?
You know, and I'm
bear can't
I'm,
get
I'm,
through
I'm,
that.
The bear goes flump. He jumps and he sort of flops his feet up onto the side of the car and is looking in the window at me, right? And this, you know, bears
this is like
are
a full grown
bears
man,
are huge.
You know,
this is one of the adults, and the thing before I could think about doing anything about it, the bear's arm was through that little vent window.
Holy!
Got to the elbow, bent, and slapped me right in the forehead.
Wow!
And I went back and down because I was probably like a preteen or teenager.
Wow. You got slapped in the face by a bear.
I got slapped
in
the face.
Bitch slapped by a
bear. And, you know, like scrapes from his fingernails, the claws.
Look at you take your head off.
Well, yeah, a little lower. It might have been my neck.
I just thought there were character lines on your head, Hillary.
Yeah,
if I had
been moved to the one side or the other, maybe the claws would have. But he wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just trying to get another box of cereal.
Sure. He was trying to get that bag of kittens.
He wanted more tricks.
I have absolutely no sympathy for people that go out into the woods and get
taunt bears.
Yeah, and like get mauled by bears because you know what?
Well, it's your own damn fault.
Yeah, it is. You know, get the
says Ranger Sal.
I'm sorry. You know what?
No.
You enter a
Yogi.
No. The mostly people that get attacked by bears have provoked that bear in some way. It's not like you're just walking along and a bear jumps you and mauls you.
People can get hurt. If there's a child, you know, if there's a young bear cub involved, that's where the problem arises often.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're caught in the wrong situation, you're walking on a trail, like on a mountainside, you can't get off it. And the
bear's certainly.
There.
I'm not saying everyone, but I'm saying a lot of times.
They would even, you know, once this happened, we were like, we want to know more about the danger of bears, right? And so, like, everywhere I go
so
in the
you wrote
park
a letter
after
to
that,
Challengers of the
I'm looking around, you know, I'm thinking there's a bear hiding behind every rock, you know.
Well, that was a lot more information than I had planned on originally on the show, but a lot of good stuff. Thanks to Hillary and Mike who stopped by. and of course John and
thank you, boys.
And Tom. But let's go ahead and end with all of our announcements here. We have if you'd like to discuss this week's show or just about anything else, you can visit us at www.aroundcomics.com, where you'll find various ways to communicate with the Around Comics crew. You can call our hotline.
You can call it at 1-888-65-GCAST. Leave us a message, and we'll play it on the show.
You can send us an email to news@aroundcomics.com, or if you'd rather contact us individually, you can send emails to Sal, Chris, or Tom at aroundcomics.com.
And while you're at aroundcomics.com, drop by the forum and join other listeners in the ongoing comic book discussion, argument, love fest, available 24 hours a day.
And while you're there, if you'd like to help us spread the Around Comics love, there's plenty of ways to do that. You can join the Listener LCS Challenge. There's a flyer on the show, or I'm sorry, on the site that you can download and print out and put it in your local comic shop. And if you do, let us know. We'll read the name and address of the shop on the show and put it on our website. You can go to ComicSpace, comicspace.com/aroundcomics, be one of our virtual friends, or you can do the same at myspace.com/aroundcomics, or Chris's favorite, you can leave us an iTunes review.
We're at 100 now.
Are we at 100? Yeah. We got, oh, well, that's good.
Way to go.
Fantastic.
We are also proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. Find more great podcasts at comicspodcast.com.
And just so everyone is aware, we post the next week's topic on Tuesdays at our forum at aroundcomics.com. Although this Tuesday I forgot to do it, so
yeah,
it wasn't actually there.
Not that good. This episode is presented by InStockTrades.com. Waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, selects hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 ship free. Whether you're buying an absolute edition or catching up with showcases and essentials, InStockTrades.com is your new best friend.
And also, we are proud to help support the Hero Initiative. Hero creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, and an avenue back to paying work. It's a chance for all of us to give back something to the people who have given us so much enjoyment. For more information, visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. Of course,
thank you.
Hillary Varda, John Suntress, Mike Norton, Tom.
Thank you.
And thanks to Mark at Dark Tower for hosting
thank
us,
you.
As always. Everyone have a fantastic week. We'll be back again on Thursday with another... Or, I'm sorry. We'll be back again on Monday with a new episode. In the meantime...
In between time.
We'll be everywhere in...
And around.
A comic. Heavily edited episode.
Would like to suggest a topic? Send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member? Email us at info@aroundcomics.com, or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Love you, baby. Yeah.